From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
The G7 is meeting in Canada, and Donald Trump says he wants to make it the G8 again. He's also going to leave the summit early, maybe because he knows he's going to get an earful about trade, Iran, climate change, and much else. Plus, we're days away from the Trump-Kim summit in Singapore, for which Trump says he doesn't really need to prepare. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow. Later in the show, we'll talk about Trump's pardon for Alice Johnson, the federal prisoner whose case Kim Kardashian West raised with the president personally. Trump says he wants NFL players to recommend pardon cases to him, even as he's stepping up his fight with football, having disinvited the Philadelphia Eagles from the White House. We'll look at the Supreme Court's punt in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case and the settlement for ZTE, that sanctioned Chinese telephone company. All that plus what Tuesday's primary results in California mean for November is coming up on Left, Right, and Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow, your center and senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. And our special guest today is David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic. On Friday morning, President Trump left Washington for Quebec, where leaders of the G7 world powers are meeting for their annual summit. And on his way out the door, he told reporters Russia ought to be readmitted to the group. Russia was expelled from the then G8 in 2014 over its annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. Trump likely wasn't looking forward to a meeting with six leaders all furious over his protectionist trade policies and who also have bones to pick with him over Iran, North Korea, climate change, and various other issues. He even intends to leave the summit early so he can get to Singapore and prepare for that other summit, which we will discuss in a little bit. Rich, is this robust American leadership that we're looking at here?
No, I don't mind being in a different place than the Europeans are on issues that matter and on things that I think are sound, withdrawing from the Paris Accords, pulling out of the Iran deal. But the tariffs on the steel and aluminum tariffs, just coupled with a general acrimonious attitude, make no sense. They're not productive. They are a distraction from the many issues we have around the world. We're actually dealing with adversaries rather than allies. So I think this whole posture is a mistake.
Felicia, aside from the implementation, and there have been criticisms over, you know, you put tariffs on metal and then people will just, you know, make finished metal goods abroad and import them with no tariff. Setting aside that, let's say that Trump had a more coherent protectionist policy. Does he have a point about U.S. workers being undermined by foreign competition, that they would benefit from a more tariff-protected trade regime that really prefers goods made in the U.S. over those made abroad?
No, he really doesn't. I mean, I agree with Rich. The kinds of tariffs that you see on steel, on aluminum, these are not going to help American workers. Instead, it's really going to hurt them. He seems to not realize many things. But in particular, you've got folks who work in ports, folks who work in companies that utilize steel and utilize aluminum. And, you know, these workers are really going to be hurt. Not to mention the fact that you think about a finished good these days. Finished goods have parts from all over the world. Supply chains are very globalized and very long. And so creating friction rather than reducing it is not the answer to the real problems that we do have in managing globalization.
David, it feels like for a year and a half, these major world leaders have been doing their best to make nice with Trump, considering the circumstances. But it feels to me like there's been a shift in tone this week that we saw both from Justin Trudeau and from Emmanuel Macron. What do you see as changing the approach that these world leaders are taking toward Trump and becoming more openly adversarial?
Well, part of it is cumulative, the gradual recognition that you're dealing with someone who is adverse to the alliance and whose relationship with Russia really cannot be explained in any innocent way. But there's something else here that is a particular trigger, and that is the authority the president used to justify the imposition of tariffs. Remember, the tariff is a tax. The president cannot impose them at will. They are prerogatives of Congress, and they're bounded by treaty. So how did these tariffs even happen? Normally, when the United States has trade disputes with Canada and Europe, it does so under the dumping laws, that because all of these treaties say that foreign producers can't sell under price. That's a very complicated set of ideas, and maybe it doesn't make any economic sense. That's not the exception President Trump used. He used the carve-out blanket exception where the president can impose tariffs in case of national security threats. He called the Canadians, the Germans, the British a national security threat. And not only is that profoundly insulting, But it has some very serious real-world consequences. Remember, these countries are also defense suppliers. In the case of Canada, it's since 1959 been bound to the United States in a single defense procurement area. Canadians are treated like Americans from the point of view of defense procurement, and that's been true since the Eisenhower administration. Why is that so explosive? Well, periodically, the United States engages in military activities that these countries' populations don't like, the Vietnam War, the Iraq War. And at that point, these governments come under pressure from their populations to put an arms embargo on the United States, not to sell. This is a huge issue periodically in Canada, where I'm from. And the governments say, we have no power to do that. We're in a defense sharing. So we don't like the Vietnam War or Iraq War any better than you do, or maybe we do. But we're going to resist public pressure because of these shared defense procurement relationships. If the Americans are today saying, you know what, we think of you guys as security challengers, that attacks not just the trading system, but the security architecture of the Western alliance.
I see Rich nodding.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very well said. And as we talked about, I guess last week, it's a great advantage to us geostrategically that we have peaceable, friendly neighbors on our northern and southern borders, and we shouldn't be reckless with that. And the fact that the steel and aluminum they produce and export to us, our dependence on them for that represents a national security threat is clearly absurd, and it's just used to find some rationale under law for the president to be able to do this unilaterally.
Felicia, what are you looking for out of the other G6 leaders here? Because I feel like, you know, they have shared frustrations about the U.S., especially on trade. All six of these countries hate the metal tariffs. They have a number of other shared interests as well. But they've taken different strategic tacks. In particular, you've still seen Shinzo Abe, the prime minister of Japan, seeming to do his best to personally butter up President Trump. It's not clear to me that it's doing him any good. But you also obviously have tensions between Angela Merkel and Germany and some of the other governments in Europe. Are these six countries able to put up a united front on a number of issues to sort of replace U.S. leadership?
Well, clearly, you see a very complicated geopolitical situation right now. We have a multilateralism that is, for a lot of people, very confusing. I think it's important to note, first and foremost, that the United States is increasingly isolated, even within that multilateralism, and that is never good, right? That is never good. And so even if American leadership is and would be weaker today than it was in 1945, that doesn't mean an isolated and petulant America is the right thing for the world. That being said, I think the new geopolitical question is really whether the G6, and there I would really focus on three. I would focus on Macron and Trudeau and Merkel. The question is, do they have enough common interest to forge important agreements on anything? And I would point to climate here as really the most important thing to look for.
Well, but climate's an easy thing to sort of say something together on. I mean, that's why every country in the world is a party to the Paris Accord except us, because it doesn't really require you to do anything. So, I mean, they can say the right things on climate, but it seems like, you know, it might be more, you know, for example, some of the trade issues that they might have between Germany and some of these other countries would be harder to bridge than that.
There's no question that that's true, and there's also no question that the pressures we're seeing on the euro these days, the eurozone, are very real. Nonetheless, I do think that, you know, agreement can follow agreement, and so I think that if the three of them in particular can find ways to work together again on climate or maybe on the larger issues within the eurozone, that's going to be an important ballast given what we're seeing in Russia, what we're seeing with obviously, President Trump, and then what we're seeing in China. And then I think Japan is, to some degree, actually a weakened outlier in all of this.
David, I want to ask you about Nord Stream 2, which is this pipeline project proposed to run from Russia to Germany under the Baltic Sea. This, I feel like, complicates some of the policy narratives we've seen here, where the U.S. has been trying to block the construction of that pipeline, in part to prevent the Russians from getting too much power from their supplying of fossil fuels to Europe. What do you make of the Trump administration taking this sort of fairly strong anti-Russia position at this time? One of the things dividing us from Europe, actually us being wanting to be tougher on Russia on this issue than they are.
Yeah, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, it's an Eastern European issue. The reason the Russians want to build this pipeline that allows them to supply gas directly to Germany, bypassing Poland, is that they never want to cut off Germany. That's too scary. They've tangled with the Germans a few times. They'd rather not do it again. But this pipeline allows them to turn off gas to Poland and to Ukraine and to other places without turning off gas to Germany. So the reason that the United States has stood strong, or not as strong as it should, against this pipeline is to protect our NATO's eastern flank. Now, it happens that this is a rare case where Donald Trump has another priority along with that of his pro-Russia policy, and that is he is very sympathetic to these increasingly authoritarian small states in Eastern Europe, which are his probably his only friends on the continent, especially the Poles, who gave him such a good time. But what we're going to see is that Germans have a lot of clout and a lot more clout than the Poles. What traditionally happens at these kinds of summits is that there is vigorous debate inside the leaders' room, which is then cushioned by cooperation outside. I don't know how much leverage Donald Trump has over Germany right now, and zero. It is going to be hard for him to win this without being able to mobilize any sympathetic opinion in Germany.
Let's talk a little bit about this ZTE settlement. This is, you know, the Chinese telephone manufacturer that we were going to lock out of being able to buy U.S. parts, essentially putting them out of business. The Trump administration is now settled with them. They're supposed to pay a $1 billion fine, and they're supposed to allow more U.S. oversight of their operations. It's unclear how that will actually work in practice. Is this a good enough settlement here? Have we held the Chinese accountable for this company's violation of Iran sanctions?
Well, I think it's something, but if you want to pressure China on trade, it's much better to have a state-supported enterprise by the throat as your leverage rather than trying to use these tariffs. And China is just playing a game that's worked for it for a very long time of having some other problem in the region that it's going to help us with. And now it's North Korea. So that gives them the leverage, oh, we're going to help you have this nice summit with Kim Jong-un. And please release this state-supported enterprise that represents like the very worst of the Chinese system. So Capitol Hill's upset about it. They should be upset about it. I'm not sure there's anything that they can or actually will do about it.
Does this deal look okay to anybody else?
Well, I'll just say that you started by asking the question that you see a lot, which is the $1 billion settlement tough enough? But, you know, and that's how the administration is trying to spin it. But I actually think that's just hand-waving. I don't think that's actually the question of the size of the settlement is really the core point at all. I think the real issue is whether ZTE, which actually supplies not just phones, but also network equipment, you know, this is ZTE is part of a larger effort of the Chinese through their One Belt, One Road policy to provide infrastructure internationally, especially to Africa. And again, this gets back to the American isolation or American retraction issue. When you see Americans, we are not able to invest in infrastructure at home, and we are certainly not able to do that abroad. This is no longer the era of the Marshall Plan. So when you see that and you see China stepping into that void, especially China that has the kind of human rights problems that are so rampant and we should be worried about, especially with a company like ZTE, I think this is a huge problem.
We can't even begin to analyze this in a rational way while the president of the United States is taking economic favors for his companies from the Chinese. You know, if we were in a different kind of administration, we would be having a vigorous debate right now between those who believe in conciliating China and trying to work with it and those who take a tougher line, and good arguments on both sides. That becomes a very different discussion when your president is receiving payments from the people he is purporting to deal with on behalf of all of America. And that's the situation with ZTE. So we don't even rise to the is this a good deal or a bad deal question, because we can't get past it's a corrupt deal.
Let's talk about the North Korea summit, which will be on Tuesday. This thing is actually going to happen, it looks like. And both David and Rich, you in recent weeks have said on this show that you're worried that we're going to come out of this meeting with Trump cutting a bad deal just so that he can say that he has cut a deal. He'll get the short-term political win, the long-term strategic loss for the U.S. This week, it seems like the White House has been downplaying expectations about this meeting, saying that they see it as the first of several conversations, the start of a dialogue. It looks to me like they're setting up so that they can say after the meeting that the talks were productive and we're going to have more talks without actually reaching a specific deal. Rich, do you agree with that assessment, and do you see that as a hopeful sign?
I think that posture is better. I still fear the consequences of this meeting, because I think Kim will obviously make some assurance on denuclearization that will be vague and phased and will be presented as a success. There'll be some sort of, if not a bro hug, a kind of some sort of bro embrace, like a shoulder grip or something like that.
And the president wants to golf with him.
There'll be warm feelings out of this, because it suits Kim's interest and it suits Trump's interest. And I fear that will be make it much harder for us to hold the line, even if we intend to do so, to hold the line on the sanctions regime. The South will take a good meeting and run with it and say, okay, let's have this infrastructure project with the North and these various other things that we've discussed with them. And it'll be very hard for us to say no. If we can't say no to the South Koreans, that'll open up the Chinese to want to do the same. So I still think it's a bad idea, but it's better for the president to be downplaying expectations rather than playing them up.
We have two crucial allies in that corner of the world, Japan and South Korea. They don't have identical interests or values, and they don't get along that well. It has taken a lot of diplomacy over many years in the United States to keep South Korea and Japan on the same page on the North Korea issue. It increasingly looks to me that what we are seeing in this summit is a very shrewd attempt by the Chinese using the North Koreans to force the United States to choose between South Korea and Japan. And Donald Trump, without quite knowing what he's doing, has been pushed toward taking the South Korean view, which is South Koreans do not want a war. They will pay almost anything to avoid it. They don't care about the nuclearization of the North because they're under threat from conventional cannon. Denuclearizing the North won't make South Korea even a little bit safer. And he's been pulled and manipulated by the South Koreans while ignoring the security interests of Japan. And if you ask, when you said earlier, why is Abe so desperately sucking up to him, Japan needs influence because they see their concerns being betrayed. They do care a lot about the nuclearization of the North. And the Chinese have worked on this, and that is the thing that people like Rich and me are so worried about, is that what we're seeing here is not just a bad summit or a bad deal. We're seeing, again, as in Europe, Trump, through malice or ignorance, is smashing structures that have been in place since the 50s to keep the world safe.
I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute, and David Frum of The Atlantic to talk about pardons. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. And David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic, is also with us. On Wednesday, President Trump commuted the sentence of Alice Johnson, a 63-year-old great-grandmother who was 21 years into a life sentence for a first nonviolent drug trafficking offense. Kim Kardashian West had personally appealed to Trump last week to let Johnson out of prison. The White House issued a statement saying, quote, "While this administration will always be very tough on crime, it believes that those who have paid their debt to society and worked hard to better themselves while in prison deserve a second chance." So I think this move is a good thing. The formal system for reviewing applications for pardon and commutation, which led to Johnson being denied three times during the Obama administration, has been too heavily weighted toward protecting presidents from political risk. There's almost no political upside to letting people out of prison, and the downsides are large. Presidents are afraid that they'll be seen as soft on crime, especially if they release people who then reoffend. So we have this system with sentences that are much too long overall and where there is a mechanism for mercy, but it's underused. And I think it's a case where Trump's incaution and disregard for institutions has actually led him to the right place, ignoring the bureaucrats, ignoring some top officials in his own administration, and swiftly letting Johnson out of prison. Am I wrong about this?
You sound like me, Josh, making the backhanded case for Trump's incaution and disrespect for our norms. You may be right about the process being overly cautious and weighted against mercy, but it doesn't have to be this capricious either. And I'm sympathetic to the argument the sentence was too long for Alice Johnson. But on the other hand, you know, saying just nonviolent drug offense, it makes it sound like she was, you know, caught smoking weed, you know, on her stoop or something, or outside somewhere when she was part of a cocaine drug ring.
Well, and sure. And 21 years in prison is a long sentence.
That's a long time. Yeah. So I don't think it's, as I say, you can make the case that the sentence is too long. But President Trump, clearly, he's got this shiny new thing that no one else has any control over, is an unreviewable plenary power of the presidency, and he really likes that.
I think you got to distinguish between the individual cases here, either the case of Alice Johnson or the case he pardoned a couple of weeks ago, Jack Johnson, the great heavyweight boxer from the early 20th century, who was imprisoned basically for being a black man who married a white woman. I mean, these are clearly cases where in the individual sense, justice is served by these people no longer being either in prison or being under some kind of judicial cloud. That being said, I think you have to look much more broadly at the power of the pardon. The power of the pardon is very strong because it's one of the few unchecked powers in all of our democracy. And you've got to be able to use it. I think it should be infrequent. We can debate that if we want. But I also think it must be used with good judgment. And clearly, when you see the range of people that, you know, he's pardoning or considering pardoning, you saw the Muhammad Ali thing. I mean, this isn't about justice or clemency. This is really just about getting headlines and trolling people. And there's no judgment here.
Politicians do good things for self-interested reasons all the time. I mean, that's the way a democracy works. You have to do things that are popular to get reelected. Sometimes that leads you to do the right thing. And I mean,
and this is the least trolly pardon yet. I think
yes,
we have to say that.
Yeah. David, what do you make of this?
As was said, the president's got a shiny new toy. You know he's not going to use it responsibly. And you know we are building toward a constitutional crisis, or you don't know it, but you sense it, over the issue of pardons of people who are accused of crimes that bear on the president, that may include members of the president's family, and that may ultimately include himself. I think the positive feedback the president is receiving right now, I mean, it's wonderful for the person who was liberated from prison, but for the country and even for himself, I think he's getting feedback that is going to encourage him to do things that are going to bring a crisis upon us faster.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Josh.
Well, so I'm not as convinced that we're
blame Barrow.
I'm not as convinced that we're going to get to that crisis as a lot of people are, and the reason for it is this: I feel like if the president was, you know, was going to pardon Mike Flynn, was going to pardon Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, why hasn't he done it already? And the answer to why he hasn't done it already is not that he thinks that would be inappropriate, or he's trying to preserve norms of the institution, or because he worries that he lacks the legal power to do it. No, the reason he hasn't done it is that he thinks the costs would exceed the benefits, that there would be real political blowback from that move, which is to say that, you know, people would resign from his administration. Maybe it would actually cause some oversight from Republicans in Congress that has been lacking. I don't know what the fear is, but it's clear that he's afraid to do that. And so for that to change in the future, there has to be a change such that the president believes that he can get away with something that he doesn't think he could get away with today.
I think it's much likelier that I don't know whether I see him ever pardoning Manafort, but I think he could pardon Flynn. But if he does, it'll be at the end of the process, the end of his administration, which is a more traditional dynamic. George H.W. Bush pardoned a bunch of people who were caught up in the Iran-Contra scandal at the end.
President Trump managed to tie this story in with his NFL feud with some comments he made this week.
If they have people, if the players, if the athletes have friends of theirs or people that they know about that have been unfairly treated by the system, let me know.
David, what do you make of this coming in the same week that he ended up disinviting the Philadelphia Eagles from the White House because he was concerned that too few of them were going to show up to the celebration of their Super Bowl victory?
Well, this is like the equivalent of the president inviting people down to the restaurant of the Trump Hotel to have a free steak on him as a way of conciliating them for some atrocious thing he's done. It makes his power too personal. You know, you asked the question a minute ago, why should pardons be rare? Remember, when the Constitution was written, there was no federal criminal law, and there were a lot of promises in the constitutional debates that there never would be, except for treason, piracy, and other kinds of international crimes. The idea of the president as a sovereign dispensing justice, that was not what they imagined in a world in which almost all crimes, virtually all except for piracy, treason, a few other things, coining money, were handled at the state level. Donald Trump is always trying to make his power personal. And that is an offense against the genius of the American system.
Yeah, I mean, I think a dynamic here, some people have pointed out as a contradiction that he's, you know, letting this drug trafficker out of prison at the same time that he's been saying that we should have the death penalty for drug trafficking. But I think the president looks at it and wants a system where both there are harsh penalties that can be imposed and then that he can waive at will. That obviously puts the maximum amount of power in his own hands. And I think that's bad. And I think we do need an overall sentencing reform. But the problem, I think, primarily lies in the laws allowing and requiring the sentences rather than in the excessive use of the pardon. Rich, I wanted to ask you about the canceled Philadelphia Eagles celebration this week. The president bringing in the Marine Band and the Army Chorus to sing the anthem and trying to make this again about the national anthem, even though no members of the Eagles had actually knelt during the anthem during the season. Is it patriotic to use the Marine Band and the anthem and the flag as a political prop in the way the president has been doing?
I don't know whether it's unpatriotic. It's extraordinarily petty. First of all, and he's done this before, the disinvitation game where you're not coming, but actually you're not canceling me because I'm disinviting you first. And then, you know, I love all that pageantry. I love all that music. But to use it to try to make a point against the NFL and this team in particular, that if you look into it, they've actually done it the right way because they haven't been kneeling. They've been very involved in the community and supporting their various causes. So this was, to put it mildly, an unedifying spectacle.
I mean, it just feels like he's just bitter that he was never able to own an NFL franchise.
Maybe. I do not know what to say about this at all, except, you know, to double down on the point that the president does want all of his power and everything to be personal. I mean, we've seen this in Donald Trump from the very, very beginnings of his career, and this is just one more step. I think, you know, you gave him, Josh, a little too much credit earlier when you said, oh, he looks at the system and wishes it were somehow more balanced between, you know, you said something about his view of the system and wanting to balance out.
This is the first time Josh has been the most pro-Trump person on the program.
And I just think that I seriously doubt that that's how his decision went when Kim Kardashian came to him and said, you know, you should commit this sentence. So.
Let's talk a little bit about this masterpiece cake shop decision. This is the Supreme Court case, the gay wedding cake case. This baker in Colorado sued, saying his rights to free speech and free religious exercise were violated when a Colorado civil rights board had cited him for refusing to bake a cake for a gay wedding. And the court largely punted on the case. They found 7-2 that the Colorado board had failed to give the baker a fair process. It didn't settle the issue of whether a fair proceeding could have required him to bake such a cake or not. Some justices filed concurring opinions arguing that question in one direction or the other. But Anthony Kennedy and John Roberts stayed silent on the issue, and their votes would control the outcome of a future decision that might actually settle some of these issues around discrimination law. David, was this decision important?
This decision is hugely important, potentially, because of the narrow basis on which it rests. I mean, the decision is not a big decision on how we balance anti-discrimination and religious freedom, but it did say that a lot of actions that might be otherwise reasonable become unreasonable if there's religious animus on the record. And here's the reason why that's so important. President Trump began his term in office with this attempted ban on Muslims entering the United States. The president's power over immigration is almost absolute. And yet courts at the lower levels have said, I don't know, as absolute as it is, if you exercise it maliciously, maybe it's not so absolute. And I think this cake decision opens a way for the Supreme Court to say, even though normally absolute, if it's malicious, you can't do it. And by the way, that will be a real loss to presidential authority for the future and something to be worried about for those of us who do want to have an effective immigration system.
Rich, do you think that's right, that this matters for the travel ban case?
I think it's possible. I would also note, you know, Kennedy rested his decision a lot on things these commissioners said, you know, not in the written final opinion, but just things they said in the course of discussing it. So the analog might be there going back to things President Trump said during the campaign and using it against the official act. And the travel ban, I like this decision, at least to think it was better than the alternative. I think a lot of these apparatchiks who are on these kind of commissions who are supposed to be anti-bias do have a bias of their own against traditional believers. I think this baker had a fundamental First Amendment right not to be coerced into creating this cake for this ceremony, but it's strategically, from my point of view, it's probably best not to have a court with Anthony Kennedy as a swing vote deciding that question.
Felicia, I saw a lot of disagreement among people on the left about how bothered to be by this decision. A lot of people are sort of framing it as a significant setback for civil rights. Other people sort of saying, well, the decision didn't do very much.
Well, you know, I think everyone's kind of claimed a half victory here, and you are absolutely right that ultimately the question of clashing rights and freedoms is not yet settled. That is not shocking. You know, the story of America obviously is a 300-plus-year story of trying to figure out how to expand our rights and freedoms and our debate over how to do that. So this particular case is much narrower, as others have said, than the kind of broad interpretation that some might try to give it. However, the real concern that I have is not about the case itself, but about how it might be interpreted kind of by business owners and by others. You know, you actually saw a Republican state representative representative in South Dakota who, right after the decision came down, posted on Facebook that basically, you know, this guy, the bakers can now turn away black people. It's, you know, it's his business. This state representative said he should have the opportunity to run it the way he wants. And if he wants to turn away people of color, that's his choice. Now, there was, you know, he got people were angry at that. He got some backlash, and that's the right thing. But, you know, I think a lot of there are still obviously very deep fights that this country, deep disagreements that this country has around race and gender. But I think most of us thought that we were past the days of sort of like, you know, lunch counter sit-ins and basic service being at the core of or hiring decisions being at the core of our disagreements. And I am concerned about how this might be interpreted.
Now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So forgive me, this is a self-referential one, but one of the great things about Twitter is that people who hate you can reach out and touch you. and since I've moved from Fox to CNN, my Twitter feed has gotten much more interesting. I'm occasionally on the Anderson Cooper show, AC360, with another guy in the center right named Scott Jennings, and someone tweeted him, "I never thought CNN could find a bigger expletive deleted than Scott Jennings, but they've done it with this lipless, whiny, windbag GOP bobblehead they've added to the panel. AC360, please don't ever invite him back. He is awful."
Oh, Rich, you have lips. Felicia Wong, what tweet struck you?
I was really struck by a tweet. The Marshall Project, which is a nonprofit news group that reports mostly on criminal justice reform, tweeted out something that was reported by the Boston Globe. And it was about a kindergarten class in Somerville, Massachusetts, that now prepares its 5-year-old students for crisis with a song to the tune of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star that is, "Lockdown, lockdown, shut the door. Lockdown, lockdown, say no more." And you know, the tweet had a photo of a really cute, you know, multicolor lined paper rendition of this nursery rhyme. But of course, it's absurd. And it's really, I thought, a horrifying sign of our times, particularly in the normalization of all of it.
David Frum, give us your tweet.
I'm not any kind of sports fan, but my son and middle child is a crazed one. And the result is that I have spent so many hours at football, baseball, and above all, hockey games over the 20-plus years that I've raised him. And I go and I watch him. I don't watch the game. But there is a tweet after the Caps, his favorite team, won the Stanley Cup that I think sort of speaks to everyone who's ever loved a sports fan as to why you do it. And it's from a account called Barstool Sports, and I won't read the long URL, but they posted it on the 8th of June at 12:18, and it shows a boy who looks to be 8 or 9 at the moment when his beloved Capitals win the cup. And you watch that boy's face and you think, that's why this human activity continues, even for those of us who on its merits find it a completely baffling way for human beings to spend time.
Rich Lowry is sitting here in his Capitals jersey with a similar lipless smile.
Go Caps.
My tweet of the week comes from Maggie Haberman, the chief White House correspondent at the New York Times. She tweets, "Yikes, I asked FLOTUS spokeswoman Steph Grisham, 45, about Giuliani saying that she believes her husband regarding Stormy Daniels. Response, quote, 'I don't believe Mrs. Trump has ever discussed her thoughts on anything with Mr. Giuliani.'" David Frum will be back with us to rant. I will be back shortly with Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute and Rich Lowry of National Review to talk about Tuesday's election results in California and around the country. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. 8 states held primary elections on Tuesday, including California, where there was a lot of bedwetting among Democrats about whether the state's unusual election system would lead to Democrats getting locked out of some key congressional districts. In California, all candidates run in one primary, and the top two finishing candidates go on to the November election. Because of high enthusiasm, Democrats had lots of candidates in some competitive districts, and if those Democrats all split the vote pretty evenly, that could have meant two Republicans taking the top two slots in some of those seats. But with most of the votes counted, it appears all the key districts will have a normal Republican versus Democrat race in the fall. That's important for Democratic hopes of retaking the House. Democrats need 23 seats to take back the majority, and there are 9 vulnerable Republican-held seats in California. Paul Mitchell joins us to break down Tuesday's results. Paul is vice president of Political Data Incorporated, a bipartisan political data firm in California. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing?
Paul, I've seen a lot of people adding up the total vote for Republicans and total vote for Democrats in these districts and trying to project from that what we might see in November. What do you see in the votes that have been counted so far from Tuesday's primary? Aside from avoiding these lockouts, was this a good result for Democrats?
Yeah, so we've done the same kind of thing. We've looked at the essentially, if you take all the votes for all the Democratic candidates and sum those up and compare it to all the votes for all the Republican candidates, you get a sense of kind of what was the size of each partisan silo. And generally, if an incumbent party, so in this case, the Republicans, can't get even over 50% for all their candidates combined in a seat that's held by a Republican, then that's kind of meaning that they're in hot water.
And so, but there's only one of these Republican-held seats where there are actually more Democratic votes than Republican votes. I've seen a lot of Democrats saying, well, we usually turn out better in November, so you should sort of take those numbers and add a point or two. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's a couple caveats to that. What you're mentioning is that there's only one seat right now where Republican, the sum of all the Republican votes is under 50%, and that's in Issa's seat, the 49th congressional, a seat that he vacated this year.
This is now Northern San Diego County.
Yeah, Northern San Diego, Southern Orange County, so it kind of overlaps the two counties. And it is seen as one of the most competitive Republican-held seats in California. Now, there's two caveats. One caveat is we still have a ton of votes to be counted. In LA County alone, there's 500,000 statewide. There's 2.6 million ballots that are currently sitting in boxes or bags and yet to be processed. And so now, taking that information and moving forward, traditionally, in a general election in November, there is higher turnout from Democrats. And most importantly, there's higher turnout from independents. Independents, as we saw in the early vote, were really underrepresented in the primary, and that's common. Independents generally don't vote in primaries. But independents in, say, Orange County or the coastal areas of the state are very progressive. And so when they come out and when you have higher Democratic turnout come out, that creates even a greater challenge for the incumbent Republicans.
Felicia, what do you see in these results, both in these congressional races and then also we have a Republican versus Democrat race for governor, which almost certainly means that Gavin Newsom, lieutenant governor, former mayor of San Francisco, will be the next governor of California?
The first question, and actually the more important question in my mind, is longer term than just these primaries. I think the question we have to ask is really whether the kind of demographic change we're seeing in California means that California really is the wave of the future for all of America. And in particular, I think the question is, whether America can integrate the kind of demographic change, immigrants, people of color that California has. We are a long way. I mean, you heard Paul just recount a number of pretty good short-term results for Democrats. This says to me that we are a long way from the very dark, quite racist anti-immigrant days of Prop 187 in the 90s. So I think that you see a California right now that is majority people of color and is also the fifth largest economy in the world. And so you are seeing success there. You see political leadership that is also people of color and kind of grew up post Prop 187. So whether it's Senator Kamala Harris or Javier Becerra. So I do see a lot of optimism long term, both in the state of California where I'm from and also nationwide.
Rich, President Trump has been really leaning into an anti-sanctuary city theme when it comes to California, and he seems proud of himself for helping a Republican get into the general election for governor. There had been talk for a long time that we might have a race in November between two Democrats, but Republicans overall got less than 40% of the vote in the governor's race primary, at least as the votes are counted today, which is a poor result even for Republicans in California. Does it matter for the Republican Party nationally if even as they are, strong and control the federal government and are doing fairly well in election results nationally, are really almost sinking into irrelevance in the largest state in the country?
Well, you'd prefer to be doing better in the largest state in the country, but they're not. And I mean, I think John Cox, it is a moral victory. Get him on the ballot. It is important in terms of turnout and might help in some of these congressional districts that will be much closer than the gubernatorial race. And you might get a little more traction on some issues than people think. But Republicans, you know, they top out the besides Schwarzenegger, the best result they've had is 43% in recent years. And if he gets that, that'll be good. I do think these results on Tuesday night, they don't show an overwhelming Democratic wave coming necessarily based on the turnout. But it was a good night for the Democrats and that they weren't locked out of any of these Republican-held Clinton House seats. And they're still on track probably to win 3 or 5 House seats coming out of California.
Paul, I'm going to ask you a question that I ask most of the pollsters and data professionals that we have on this show, which is that I feel like we've seen a little bit of a disconnect over the last year between the polling results. As Rich notes, the polls have been volatile, and it looked for a while like they were maybe significantly improving for Republicans. And at the same time, you've had these special election results that have looked extremely favorable to Democrats, pretty far out of line with the national polling on the congressional generic ballot. What is your view about how to reconcile those data points? And in your view, are we in a position where the Democrats are sort of ahead by a little bit in the congressional race for November, or are we in a position where they're ahead by a lot?
Well, first off, reconciling this is tough. And I think as we get closer to November, that's when these data points are actually going to mean more. In terms of our congressional races here in California, you know, these are races that shouldn't be competitive right now. And I'm saying that because this is a gubernatorial election cycle. These are Republicans who survived an incredible Democratic year in 2016 here in California. They had survived an incredible Democratic year in 2012 and in 2008. And for the most part, these Republicans have been able to win in elections where essentially in California, they ask, is there going to be a Democratic wave? We're always in a Democratic wave in California. Even in the years when the nation had big Republican waves in 2010 and 2014, California in 2010 was the only state that picked up a legislative seat for Democrats. These Republican members of Congress are like the antibiotic-resistant strain of Republicans. These are folks who have been able to survive multiple great Democratic years in this state. So the fact that they're even vulnerable now is really surprising. And I think we will see potentially Democrats picking up a couple of these.
It's funny, though, Felicia, because what Paul just said there about these Republicans in places like Orange County and other suburban and Central Valley areas of California, I feel like you could have told the same story in 2010 about a large number of white Democrats in the House of Representatives from the South and say, you know, well, yes, the trends are going the other way, but they've held on so long through good and bad cycles. And then they basically all got defeated. So it's sort of like some of these things, they don't happen. And then they do happen.
Right. Well, I think the thing about California is this really is built on 20 or 25 years of movement organizing in LA and elsewhere. So that's why I think it's so important to look back at the state's past. The other thing I will just add about Republicans in the state, they are scared, right? Chad Mays, who's a Republican in the state, has started something called New Way California, and the core at which, and I think Schwarzenegger has joined him, and the core point for New Way is that they want to embrace immigration. I think they understand very well the complexity of the issue, but they also know where voters in California and residents in California are. That state is, you know, Paul will know the numbers better than I, but that state tends to be 70-75% pro-immigration reform. So that's an important thing to notice.
Paul, let's talk a little bit about the role of immigration in this election. I thought there was a really interesting result in the 10th district. This is a swing district in the Central Valley based in Modesto, held by Republican Jeff Denham. And Democrats appear to have avoided a lockout here, but they could have had one because a Republican ran to Denham's right on immigration, managed to pull 14% of the vote in the primary with almost no money. Is that a result of surprise? And what does that say about the position that California Republicans are caught in on immigration, opposed by Democrats and also opposed by some in their own party who want to pull them to the right?
Well, you know, the Denham seat is really interesting. Denham seat and that whole area of the Central Valley, you end up having a lot of Democratic voters who will vote for Republicans. And a lot of that breaking has to do with issues around immigration. The shocking thing for me about the 10th district is when we first started this conversation, we were talking about the sum of all the Democratic votes and the sum of all the Republican votes. that was a very close election in terms of overperformance of not just Democratic voters turning out. We won't know the actual numbers of that for a little while, but the number of votes for Democratic candidates and that ratio between Democrat and Republican is more advantageous to Democrats than we've ever seen. And that makes this district very interesting. There was a possibility that there would be two Republicans making the top two in that district. It was probably a more remote possibility than some of the Orange County seats. But still, this is, I think, a very volatile area.
Rich, Jeff Denham, that congressman from the Central Valley, is one of the key leaders among Republicans in the House of Representatives pushing to vote on something to fix the DACA program before the November elections. Republicans are still negotiating about that, and Denham and his allies could force a vote on a DACA fix using a procedure called a discharge petition. But these votes, I think, show the challenging position that he and a lot of Republicans are in, where he feels that in order to be well-positioned for November, he needs to show that he's trying to push something on immigration reform. But that caused a significant revolt among members of his own party. And I have to imagine a lot of different Republican members are looking at those two pressures and don't know which one is the bigger electoral threat.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly immigration. Trump's views on immigration obviously are a wedge issue for Republicans like Denham and those sort of districts. But I think immigration is, we're seeing its transformation into a kind of issue for Republicans. It's a little bit like abortion, where it's going to be kind of a core orthodoxy of the party. And if you're someplace, more in favor, have more liberal views or in favor of an amnesty, you're inviting a primary challenge, the same way you do if you're a pro-choice Republican almost anywhere in the country. So I think Denham is sort of the leading edge of a trend that's going to be uncomfortable for Republicans in those sort of districts.
Felicia, as Republicans in the House sort of work out this fight over whether they'll vote on anything on immigration and what, is there anything for Democrats to do right now aside from sort of point to what Republicans are doing and say, this is bad, vote us in? I mean, a few months ago, we had Democrats, shutting down the government for a few days in an effort to use the appropriations process to force an immigration fix.
Well, I think Rich's point that immigration is a really tough issue for Republicans right now. It's actually a difficult issue for some Democrats right now. And I have heard some people say that Democrats should avoid immigration. It's kind of like a political kryptonite. And I think absolutely, given what the Trump administration has done on immigration, that idea that you should lean away, that Democrats should lean away from immigration is absolutely the wrong thing. This is one place where I think there is a true moral argument to make and that Democrats should go ahead and make it. I mean, I do not, I think reasonable Democrats, reasonable Republicans, reasonable Americans can disagree on how to handle immigration broadly. But I think what we're seeing now with ICE really propagating a very specific terror strategy, yes, to take kids, very young kids, away from their families, or even to, prosecute law-abiding people, deport them for, not using their blinker while turning right at a stoplight. This is not an America that I think most people, even if they are in the middle, really want to live in. And so this is something that I think Democrats should actually talk about.
Paul Mitchell, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Felicia Wong, what's your rant?
Well, I don't think we're seeing a lot of the truth about what's really developing on the progressive side of the aisle. Most of what I see is people kind of obsessed with, frankly, something that is a year, 18 months old at this point, this narrative that the Democrats have an identity crisis. But if you really go a little bit under the hood, that is not what's happening. You're seeing both on the federal level and on the state and local level that very big ideas are being talked about. Tom Perriello and I have called this the victory of bold over old, right? You see winning candidates that are moving to real solutions. Now, we can debate these solutions. I'm sure we would on this show. But there's no question that you see ideas like job guarantees and public banks rather than Wall Street banks, solutions that are not just tweaking around the edges. This is where candidates are moving now. You saw Medicare for All as a really fringe idea during the Obama era, and now a third of Senate Dems are moving there. And I don't think this is just because sort of a bread and circus, give the people what they want attitude is what's out there. I think that Democrats understand that in an era of mass disruption, whichever party has like really bold ideas has the opportunity to really define politics for a generation. That's what's happening. I don't see enough people talking about it.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Over the last 20 years, Charles Krauthammer has been one of the most notable commentators in America. Acerbic but civil, principled but unpredictable. He's been absent from the air and in print over the last several months, fighting a battle with cancer that he's now announced that he'll lose in the next few weeks. As one of the cadre of young research assistants who've worked for Charles over the years, I'd like to take the opportunity to thank him for being a role model for all of us of how to be a public advocate and, more importantly, of how to be a human being.
David Frum, what's your rant?
A registration card was made out for every prisoner who was sent to the Soviet Gulag for the decades of terror that the Soviet system lasted. Those cards were preserved for historical study after the fall of the Soviet Union. It's just been revealed that under a secret order issued by the Putin government, the Soviet state, or the Russian state, has begun destroying those cards since 2014, an act of erasure of historical memory that is designed to erase the memory of a terrible crime. This erasure is itself a terrible crime and an attack on the truth.
For my rant, the celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain took his own life this week at the age of 61. What I most admired about Bourdain was the way he'd wandered and overcome adversity and substance abuse in his early adulthood and found his way eventually to greatness. What Bourdain was great at wasn't cooking. He was very good at cooking, and Les Halles was a good restaurant, though not a great one. Bourdain's true greatness was in storytelling. His memoir, Kitchen Confidential, changed the way I thought about food and restaurants, and he developed a style of unpretentious food journalism that has spawned many imitators, some of them good imitators, but none as good as him. His blunt and empathetic style had impacts beyond food, most notably in his outspokenness on Me Too, driven by the experiences of his girlfriend Asia Argento, who is one of Harvey Weinstein's accusers. I find it very unfair that he has killed himself. He leaves behind a girlfriend, a child, friends, people who worked on his show, all of whom deserve more of his time, and I think a lot of us would have liked more of his time, too. It just sucks. Don't do this. If you are feeling in crisis, please know you're not alone. You can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-8255. That is all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Felicia Wong, David Frum, and Paul Mitchell. Sarah Fay produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Berskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.